this week, most markets ended the year in the red with one big exception. The NASDAQ gained 6% in 2015 thanks to triple-digit returns in Netflix and Amazon shares. Well, happy new year as we celebrate not only a new year, but a decade with you on the digital airwaves. Now that the first Fed rate hike in a decade has finally come to pass, we've had some time to watch the market's reaction, and investors not too pleased without the backing of the Fed put, as they call it. You know, low rates were a virtual guarantee of share price success. Plus, higher rates has bond investors unnerved, particularly high yield and junk bonds. After such a tricky year, who better to help decipher 2016 and what it'll mean for the financial markets and your portfolio than Martin Armstrong, the forecaster? He's the subject of a must-see documentary. At the heart of his methodology, international money flows, and we've certainly seen a lot of that with the greenback as Europeans, as well as money from the EU, as well as Eastern Asia continues to pour into the greenback amid their negative interest rates and talk of more Fed rate hikes. And if you like the stock market, well, you're going to love this conversation. He's looking for 26 to 27,000 on the Dow. That's at least a doubling from here, with an upside moonshot, maybe 40,000 on the Dow Jones. Remember Cadillac's 40,000 prediction right in the year 2000? Let's hope this isn't a similar occurrence. Then Bob Hoy rejoins the show, the senior investment strategist of Institutional Advisors. He's looking for a paper asset implosion. He says it's just a matter of time, parroting the comments, I think, and sentiments of many of our guests that you've heard here. You know, the tipping point could be the junk bond market, where we're seeing soaring yields and crushed prices. So hard assets will once again lead to economic survival, but let's be cautious here because the Fed is expected to raise rates another 75 basis points at least in the new year. A great portfolio diversification tool for now. And as a New Year's resolution, I'd like to throw this into the ring. How would you like to contribute to saving a million lives? So I'm not exaggerating here, and I'm going to just throw some numbers out there, and you can either agree or agree to disagree. That's up to you. Each day that we have a vegan or vegetarian diet, we contribute to saving roughly three lives. That's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Three lives and probably many more. But, you know, three times 365 days, that's 1,000 lives a year. 10 years, well, 10,000 lives. Live several decades, you could be looking at 30 to 50,000 lives. But it gets even better because each person you convert, depending on stage in life, you could be talking another 50 to 100,000 lives saved. 10 converts, including yourself, that's a million lives or more. Veggie burgers, veggie sausages, veggie bacon. Oh, it's gotten so much better nowadays. And forget all that cholesterol. Add years to your life, up to 10 years for the typical male, 7 for the typical female, and save hundreds of thousands of lives in the process, untold misery. You can make a difference. One person. This is one of those rare opportunities. You know, we always hear we can make a difference. We can reduce our carbon footprint. One place that you really can make a difference, save money, improve your health, and live longer. There you go. New Year's resolution, anyone? GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, mostly cloudy skies appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week. Following the first U.S. rate hike in a decade, gold gave back $15 only. That's about 1.5%, finishing at $20.60 an ounce. Silver dropped 56 cents, about 4%, ending at $13.82. The XAU and silver shares index fell about 2.5 points, 5%, down to $45.30. West Texas Intermediate crude dropped about a dollar, 3% down to 37 per barrel, and frankly, odds favor much lower prices in the months ahead. The top story driving the precious metals markets this week, once again, dollar strength as investors anticipate further rate hikes by the Fed in the new year. 2016, widely anticipated about another 1% rate hike in total, at least. That's 75 basis points above our last 25 basis points in the overnight lending rate. The Fed Funds futures contract indicates solid odds of rate hikes early in the year. And the greenback has added nearly 10% this year, putting downward pressure across the commodity sector. Nevertheless, gold holding up well relative to its less shiny cousin copper, which is off 25% for the year, while iron ore off 43% and crude oil about 36% for the year. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, now that the rate hike genie is out of the bottle, clearly we will see 75 basis points total and then at least a point and higher next year, probably early, I would guess. So that's likely to put some more pressure on the sector. Still lower prices, lowers the dollar cost averaging of the best portfolio insurance. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds reappeared over the New York Stock Exchange, although it was a volatile year. The Dow was down only 2.2% for the year, finishing near break-even. And if you include the dividend yield, well, it earned a positive return. The S&P 500 lost about half a point, faring better for the year. But the NASDAQ Tech Heavy Index, well, added nearly 6% thanks primarily to Netflix and Amazon.com. Who can live without them? The top performing stocks, 134% and 120% roughly. The Dow finished for the week at 17,425, off 127, less than a percent. While the S&P 500 ended at 2043, off 17, less than a percent, and the NASDAQ fell just 41, less than a percent, holding above that 5,000 level at 5,000. And seven. One of the hardest hit sectors holding the stock indexes back was the U.S. energy sector this year, which suffered from the 31% decline in oil futures. The energy sector, the biggest decliner in the S&P 500, fell 24%, while the major component, Chesapeake Energy, was off 77%. That's the biggest decliner in the S&P. Plus, junk bonds and high-yield bonds fell 10% by the iShares iBoxx ETF, high-yield corporate bond exchange-traded fund. That's the largest junk bond ETF, again, off 10%. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our favorite seven component sentiment index is still just in the neutral territory, and there are big signs of technical weakness across the indices. We're seeing that favorite of mine, the Bitcoin ETF, soaring yet again, and I think it's ready to double from these levels. So my Alpha Stocks newsletter folks, be sure and log in and get that ticker symbol. In fact, just before the fall smackdown, the Dow Jones was hovering for 4 weeks and then lost 2,000 points, just a matter of trading days. In similar fashion, the Dow continues to tread water now in its fourth week. And I think you might see a capitulation beginning as soon as next week. The CBOT, the VIX, continues to show increased volatility, and it also looks like there could be more. So for the time being, higher yield seems to have virtually everyone unnerved. So caution advisable. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Robert Ian wrapping up the show. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Armstrong, the author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, founder of Princeton Economics, and of course his latest, The Forecaster, the must-see documentary/movie about his astounding life. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're back in from Europe. I assume it was a speaking tour or something.
Well, we have our conferences. They're kind of like mini UN get-togethers. There's a world that we call them the World Economic Conference. We have one here in the States, and then we have one in Berlin. So clients fly in from all over the world, and it's really good because you get to meet people from everywhere, and you get to see the capital flows right there in the room.
Well, yeah, capital flows. That's a good topic to start off with. On your interesting documentary, The Forecaster, much more than just the typical docudrama. Capital flows in and out of a nation, an important key to your analysis whenever you're looking at the potential for a prospective break in an economic paradigm, or at least in a specific economy. We've seen a lot of that. Argentina, Venezuela. Do you see anything else like that?
Well, sure. I mean, capital flows around the globe, and people don't quite appreciate this so much, but it's becoming a bit more obvious to them now. But for years, back in the 80s, when I was doing a lot of business in Geneva, everybody was there handling OPEC money, etc. In the late 80s, I'm off over in Japan, and initially I thought, gee, I don't know anybody over here, being asked to go over. And here, a lot of the top brokers that were handling the OPEC money in Geneva had migrated to Japan. The capital not only moves around the world, but so does the talent. After the Japan bubble, what happened? And they say, okay, what's next? And they all ran down to Southeast Asia. That goes into a bubble by 97, and so we get the Asian currency crisis. They go, oh, what's next? Oh, they're going to start the euro next year. And they all run into that. So it's always this rush around the world sort of thing. Governments, it's very important because politicians, it really shows that honestly, they're full. They're full of it. I mean, they can't do anything that they claim that they can do, and that's part of the problem we're seeing in political elections everywhere. I mean, they're dumbfounded, half the time why Trump is at the top. But if you look around the world, it's the same thing everywhere. In Scotland, they threw every member of the Labour Department out of Parliament. People are fed up.
Just saw today on the headlines, the Pope actually is expecting a potential for World War III today. You've got your finger on the pulse of the geo-economic situation better than most. What are your thoughts on a potential wide-scale conflict? This sounds like something of a wake-up call. Do the elite know something that the rest of us need to know here?
I've been told a lot of them are starting to look at our models a bit more. But effectively, it isn't really like Nobel Prize-winning stuff here. I mean, we took the world economy, we reconstructed everything from the coinage, etc. You can see charts on the Roman economy that we reconstructed. And you correlate that for thousands of years with war. And it comes up with a very simple explanation. We do not go to war when everybody's fat and happy. Turn the economy down, everything starts going. You have to understand, all right, 1933, yes, FDR was elected, confiscated gold, etc. That's a very myopic view. 1933, Hitler was also elected, and so was Mao. So this is a global thing. It is you turn the economy down, and everybody gets angry at somebody else.
That's an interesting phrase, turn the economy down. I think that's appropriate. And didn't we just see that last week with the FOMC turning the economy down? Certainly by raising rates first time in almost 10 years, that's going to be a sea change event, some reverberations through the economy, don't you think?
The Fed was positioned and should have raised rates in June and was going to. And what happened, the IMF came out publicly, and you can look, Google it out. You'll see that they turned to the press criticizing the Federal Reserve that they should not be raising rates because of other problems in the world. You have the emerging markets that since 2007 effectively borrowed in dollar terms, because they did it in dollars, the equivalent of half the U.S. national debt. They have nothing to pay it back with. Their economies are imploding, and the higher the dollar goes, the more they owe, and the less they earn because commodities go down. The Fed is in a huge problem, and that is that by keeping interest rates very low, it's ridiculous. The banks do not pass on any benefit to borrowers. So that's just total nonsense. The only thing it does is increases the balance sheets for banks. That's all. They make a windfall production out of it. They pay people for deposits nothing. You still want to go get a fully, a car loan or something that's fully collateralized? What do they want? 4% and more. The historic spread between bid and ask is at all-time record highs. So the banks love this, and Yellen realizes what's going on. She's been telling everybody we have to normalize interest rates, because what's happening is the pension funds are all going bust. Most of them needed 8% just to be able to break even. And we're not talking about just private ones. We're talking about the ones that she's really worried about are all the states, New Jersey, Illinois, for example. I mean, they could even pay the lottery winners. So, you know, her raising rates is actually something else. It is when you do a simple correlation, guess what? The stock market rises with rising interest rates. It declines with lower interest rates. And the reason is quite interesting. It's all before this Marxist idea. If you read the newspapers pre-1929, the Fed would raise rates and everybody would cheer. That proves the economy's strong. People are still bidding for money. Let's go higher. All right. When interest rates come down, they're trying to stimulate because nobody wants to buy. So if you look at interest rates, they doubled between 1927 and 29. They went from 3% to 6%. And then from 1929 to 1932, when the Dow fell 90%, they went basically from 6 to 1. So when you actually do the correlations on this stuff, it's opposite of what they say on TV.
So maybe we should move into, the precious metals. Very tough 4 or 5 years for the yellow metal, for AG. Do you see any silver lining here on the horizon? Will they outperform with higher rates?
No, really, it has nothing to do with the higher rates just yet. A lot of them, I mean, this is typical. You are in a period where I know a lot of people, you end up being dollar haters, and they keep saying, it's got to crash. They don't realize how bad everything is outside the United States.
That's the key, yeah.
The euro is a basket case, absolute basket case. I mean, they're using draconian measures, trying to force people not to do things. And the currency, they never properly designed it. There had to be one national debt for Europe, and they didn't do it. They left every country with its own debt. So you have the same problem emerging, in the emerging markets that you have in Europe. Why did Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal get into trouble? Because they sold them this idea of joining the euro. The euro then went from 80 cents to $1.60. Okay, now, if you borrowed Mexican pesos and the peso doubles in value, you now owe twice as much. And this is what has absolutely stripped mine Southern Europe. And it's creating a tremendous problem. You have unemployment there among the youth over 60%. I mean, this is civil unrest. This is your war cycle. I mean, people can't take this. And then instead, Brussels, understanding that this is their fault, what have they done? They're enforcing tax collection more. And they're now starting on Greece, and you're going to see this migrate to other countries. They must report everything they have, right down to jewelry, as of January 1st. Anything you have, not in a bank. So if you've got cash underneath your mattress, how much do you have in gold jewelry? I mean, if you have a lot of gold jewelry on and you hop on a plane in Italy, guess what? You get pulled over and they weigh it. I mean, people don't realize how bad this is getting. I just came back from Europe. This is the first time I get pulled over. They're not looking for trinkets, how much, alcohol or cigarettes or how many T-shirts did you buy. The first question out of his mouth was, how much cash do you have on you? I looked at him and I said, about $2,000. And they go over and search absolutely everything, and I had to show them a receipt. Look, I took $2,000 out. I left with it in case something happens to a credit card. I'm not stranded. I didn't spend it. Here's my withdrawal slip from a U.S. bank. Okay, fine, and I left. But they still kept me there for a half hour going through everything. and are only looking for money.
You know, and that really, I think, is a good tie-in into this cashless society. It's a theme that we see gaining momentum around the world, not just in the U.S., not just domestically, but all over. As a result of that, and I think a lot of currency unrest around the world, we see Bitcoin taking off, doubling in just a matter of weeks yet again, showing all kinds of signs of life. Folks can now trade it as an ETF. It's something like GBTC, I think, is the NASDAQ ticker symbol. Do you see the cashless society idea mantra as another risk to our liberties?
Oh, yes. I mean, the whole thing is all about taxes. Maybe a lot of people aren't aware of it, but as of 2017, the G20 have agreed that everybody has to share information on everybody. So, whatever you do, if you go down to Mexico and you bought a house or something, they will have to report it to the United States that, hey, you own property now. They're looking for money absolutely everywhere. I went over to London from Brussels. I was there in some high-level meetings, and dressed. So I had a suit and tie on, and I ran over to hop onto the train to run over to for a meeting, through the tunnel in London. So I happened to be the only one actually dressed. Everybody else was in jeans and sneaks. Again, I'm the one called over. This was, the British customs. They say, you, come here. I said, yeah. Showed my passport. Look, I'm not British. I'm American. That still wasn't good enough. They said, okay, let me see your ticket. I said, my ticket. They went to see where I bought it. If I bought my ticket in London and was I returning, I said, no, I bought it in Brussels and I'm just here for a meeting and I go back to the States from Frankfurt. Okay, fine. Then they let me go. It's all money. That's all it is. And this is what this cashless society is about. If they can eliminate physical paper money, and everything has to be in a bank, then they can collect every possible, penny of tax that they think they're entitled to. And this is what they're doing to Greece. The Greeks, as of January 1st, have to report everything they have. And it's under criminal, penalties.
Do you see something like that coming to our doors?
Eventually. The EU is doing this to Greece. The same way when they started the bail-ins, taking people's money to bail out the banks and the deposits. They did that first in Cyprus, and they watched to see if they got away with it. They did. So they then expanded the idea to everywhere else. They're now doing this, reporting everything you have.
What about listeners that are scratching their heads thinking, okay, yes, you're right, they did get away with it, but does that really tie in with the top of this cartel? Because can't they just print an unlimited amount of money? Why would they need to steal from mom and pop if they've got the control of the printing presses?
Because they don't see it that way. They really don't. And the people that buy the bonds are the ones that are telling them, no, you can't do that. They don't want to be paid back with funny money. So what you get is more austerity. It's more draconian. The deficits still keep rising, true. But they become much more draconian in the sense of trying to collect taxes, raising taxes, everything they possibly can get. This is why the G20, as of 2017, is going to share information on absolutely everybody.
Okay, so let's shift over to the domestic economy for a minute. Your work has been on spot with many calls and over the decades, but one of the more recent cycles that seems to be of relevance to our listeners is a potential downturn for U.S. equities. We saw some of that a couple months ago. I had a little scare. Do you see anything bigger like that, or will the presidential election put it off even further?
No, it could push it off. It looks like the real big volatility period is probably 17 going into 20. The stock market's not going to crash and go to 10 cents on the dollar. If anything, it's going to probably go up, and you could see the Dow hitting at least the 25, 26,000 area. If not, you go all the way and you go up to about 40,000. Why? Because at some point in time, the real capital looks at this and realizes what you're talking about, you know, funny money and printing and stuff like that. They basically realize that this is a joke, and it becomes capital preservation. So at that stage in the game, you're looking at things, just all sorts of tangible assets then start to rise as the hedge against government. And that's the end of the cycle. So we're probably at that point looking for some sort of monetary collapse, change. The part of what we're looking at right in here is that this pushes everything up quite dramatically, because the system of borrowing, it's just nuts. I mean, there is no intention of paying anything back. And, I mean, you can go to our site and look. We've published charts on this. 70% of the national debt is accumulative interest. So it didn't go for building roads or schools or helping the poor or anybody. And, you know, it basically goes out as interest out the back door. This is why the banks have such a control over government. They get bailed out every time because they threaten them. And they say, well, you know, if you don't bail us out, then who's going to sell your debt? And so it's been this blackmail game that's been going on for a long time. And they get to do anything they want. They control the courts. They control the government. And, I mean, I know people in Capitol Hill, and they said they would never, you know, investigate Goldman Sachs. And you ask them why. It's because everybody's looking to work for them at some point when they retire.
Give us your overview of what you think we could see. Maybe if we look forward into 2016, throw some topicality in there and any forecasts or predictions, if you like, please.
It looks as though, you know, we'll probably at least get an initial low, if maybe not the final low on most of the commodities. It really kind of depends upon how we close year end on a lot of these things. I mean, gold, you close below the 1040 area, and you're going to crack the 1,000 next year. And oil, the real huge number is at like $32. If it closes below that for the year end, you're never going to see oil make new highs. I mean, it will rally back, eventually get maybe back to $50 and then fall back down again. But we're also in a very dramatic sea change as far as technology is concerned. You know, you have Teslas. I mean, when I went to Amsterdam, the taxis are Teslas. The advance in battery technology, et cetera, cars are being replaced. BMWs, within 2 years, expecting to have electric cars for absolutely every model. So the U.S. also has become the largest producer of oil. People don't realize this, but it actually has exceeded Saudi Arabia. This is with, you know, fracking, et cetera. So, I mean, there is quite a glut of oil on the market, which is why price has been coming down and people don't quite understand what's going on. But this is disrupting budgets absolutely everywhere. It's making the effectively wiping out a lot of the BRICS in Russia, Brazil. It's having a very, very major impact in shifting things around, but this is part of the whole structure where eventually, when we get through this tunnel, the light on the other side is going to be some sort of new monetary system. And hopefully at that point, we will get to the stage where we will no longer be borrowing money. You borrow money if you intend to pay it back. Effectively, what they should be doing is just increasing the money supply to cover the cost of government. And if you eliminate, you know, taxation, the cost of government can be really just kept at well below 10%. Almost 40% of the cost of government is trying to collect taxes. And taxes are no longer necessary at the federal level. They were necessary when money was coins, gold, silver, et cetera. Then you couldn't just print it. You had to get some back. We've passed that stage. I mean, that was pretty much still part of the barter-type economy. We're beyond that. Really, the wealth of a nation, I think, was set out by Adam Smith and his invisible hand, but it's been proving absolutely correct. It's not even the resources a country has, it's commodities or gold reserves or anything. It's its people. And the proof of that is just look at Germany, Japan, and China. Germany was absolutely devastated. It has risen. Why? Because of its people to the strongest economy again in Europe. All right, they're very productive, very efficient. Japan, all right, had nothing, all right, not even resources. They had to import everything. They rose to the second largest economy in the world. You look at China. Now, I can tell you what the difference is between China and Russia. I've been to both before, you know, the walls have fell, etc. The difference is Stalin versus Mao. Stalin was concerned about what you thought about. All right, if children were raised to say that the state is really your parents, and if your biological parents speak ill against the government, report them. All right, so Stalin was paranoid, and he basically really suppressed human activity and human nature. China took the opposite approach. China, they had what was called the tall poppy syndrome. They really didn't care what you thought. If you stuck your head up, it got cut off. If you kept your mouth shut and you were behind closed doors, they didn't care. Stalin cared. So you can see the difference in the sense that the Chinese people were never oppressed, from a standpoint of their natural human nature. So they responded as soon as they could, immediately right back. Russia went from basically communism to an oligarchy.
You sort of see some tie-ins there with the repressive ideologies and policymaking all throughout the Western world?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, I can tell you, people I speak to in Europe all the time, they're calling it now that, and some politicians are even now publicly calling it, Europe is the Soviet Union of Europe.
I don't think we ever expected to see anything quite that extreme. Are we referring mostly to socialist policies and ideologies here?
It's more than that. They have actively gone after, they've had the head of Italy removed. They have sent in their own people to really rig the elections in Scotland. Portugal, the people voted for a party to get rid of, to leave the EU. They wouldn't even allow them to take office. In Spain, they came down and said they had no right to even vote for it. They are trying so hard to oppress any resistance to leave the euro because they know this is all about Brussels and their jobs. If the euro goes, why do we need bureaucrats in Brussels? They could care less what happens to the continent or to the people. This is now all about government surviving. And so it's becoming extremely draconian. And you talk about democracy is dead. All right. First of all, we never had democracy. At best, we had was a representative-type government. But look at Europe. All right, you can vote for someone to go sit in Parliament in Brussels. Very nice. The Commission does not have to listen to them. It's a ceremonial vote. The Commission decides what they want to do. They're under no obligation to follow whatever Parliament even votes on. Secondly, you have the Troika, okay? Head of the ECB, the head of the EU Commission, and the head of the IMF. None of them, all right, stand for election. It's a complete dictatorship. We live in this facade, and the free press does not tell anybody what's really going on. But you know, if you're a European, you said, look, I had enough of this. I think these people are wrong. Okay, I want to vote against them. You don't even have a right to vote.
It's a star chamber, a hidden room filled with smoke, and they're calling the shots and you can have your elections, but they're rigged anyway, and it's not going to affect anything at the top.
No, and you can't even vote for the people at the top. They don't ever have to stand for election.
You know, Martin, it kind of brings me back to your idea here of maybe 24, 25, 40,000 on the U.S. Dow Jones. You know, and that really, I think, ties in, or there's some parallels between the hyperinflation that we saw in the Weimar Republic, you know, around 21 to 23. You saw the stock market take off like a rocket, but so did anything, any place you could hide your money, because, you know, inflation was just destroying everything. Do you see anything like that in the cycles?
What people don't realize about the Weimar situation was that you got to look a little bit closer. All right. It was a communist revolution in 1918. That was the Weimar Republic. They even invited Russia to please come in and take Germany. But what made it hyperinflation? And it's not the fact that they were printing money. That's not the issue. The issue was they defaulted on all the government debt. Whatever the previous government owned, they said they're not honoring. You wiped out all kinds of savings. You wiped out banks and stuff. So, yes, it ended up that they ended up having to print money because there was nothing else left. Totally destroyed the credibility of the government. Nobody would lend the money, so they had no choice but to print. And that's really what the hyperinflation was about. It was a complete collapse of the debt structure. All right. Now, we don't reach that in the West without such a similar situation. All right. And we're in a sovereign debt crisis, and that's what the real crisis is about. When the big capital begins to realize, wait a minute, you know, this is just getting more bailouts, more bailouts, more bailouts, and the people that are broke are bailing out the other people that are broke. Then you start seeing capital move. This is why, you know, people keep saying, oh, the stock market's overvalued. Retail participation's at historic lows. How can you have a bubble? It's impossible. All right. Plus, I can tell you, you know, the joke has always been that the financial gods of Wall Street are not that gracious. They don't give you 10 times to sell the high. They give you one shot. All right. 1929, 1980 in gold, 89 in Tokyo. They give you one shot. They don't keep bringing the market back to the same price level time and time again. All right, the Dow went up to 1,000 in 1966, went back up in 68, went back up in 73, went back up in 1980, finally 85, it blasted through. It went from 1,000 to 6. All right, that's what we're looking at. The Dow keeps coming up here, testing this, you know, this 18, 19,000 level constantly. All right, it is telling you this is going much higher. All right, and that's what I said, it's going to see at least the 25, 26 area. The question is only time. All right, clearly our computer is showing from 17 on, it's like everybody goes, we're really in trouble. And it's not just, you know, people that maybe are your listeners, or when does it get to them? All right, that seems to be from 17 onward. So that's what we really have to look for. When does the majority say, what's going on?
So, you know, it really also boils down to capital inflows from around the world, because, you know, you have Europe talking about even further into negative territory on their benchmark lending rates. The bottom line is there's nowhere else to park your money and earn any kind of reasonable return other than U.S. equities.
That's pretty much it. The U.S. in the $1.1 trillion spending package they did for Christmas, in there is they repealed the foreign investor tax, which was put on in the late 1980s because the Japanese were coming and buying all the trophy stuff. So it was very an anti-Japanese movement, actually. And they repealed that. So now foreigners can come in, they can buy whatever they want. And most of this was lobbying from foreign pension funds. Money's just coming here. This is what's pushing the dollar up. You look down anywhere, and Britain basically threw out pretty much all foreigners is in the real estate market. So the market over there, the property market in London crashed like almost, you know, 12% in the first month. It's down probably closer to a third already. But instantaneously, my sources in New York said as soon as they passed that measure, they were buying properties in New York. Because what's happened is, all right, I published, and you can see a chart on the French stock market. The major high is still 2000. That's what socialism has produced. They've chased everybody out. Nobody with any real sizable capital will stay there anymore. Goodyear closed down. Why? I mean, you may have heard it. The workers kidnapped the head of Goodyear and his family until they got their wage increases. And the government doesn't do anything about this. Oh, well, yeah, it's a labor movement. Yeah, they're entitled to do. To kidnap you and your family until you acquiesce and give the union what they demand? Goodyear has shut down this plant. I mean, would you want to run it? Who is going to take their family there when your family can be kidnapped if you don't agree to workers', you know, demands?
And fully sanctioned by the government.
And so all the other stock markets have made new highs, not France. France has been in the bear market since 2000, and they still don't get it. You know, well, we're just going to raise more taxes. You know, there isn't anybody else left to tax. You know, so they leave. And I was in London in a restaurant, and everybody was speaking French. And I looked, am I in Paris or am I in London? They were all French that moved to London because they won't live there.
Okay, so as we wrap up today, why don't you tell people, just give them an overview of The Forecaster, the must-see film here in 2015. Any other contact information or what else you're working on today?
Well, most of what you can see what we're working on is at ArmstrongEconomics.com. The movie is interesting. I mean, it was actually funded by Europeans. I had two other offers to make one by Americans, and I turned them down because, honestly, I didn't think that, you know, any kind of a film produced in the United States could be free from interference from government or the banks. And they are going to make a Hollywood movie out of this now, and which is interesting, but again, it has to be funded from outside the country, because people I've spoken to in Hollywood, they said they would love to make this movie. And I said, what's the problem? They said the funding comes from the banks. So the banks aren't going to fund something that exposes what they do. So it's kind of a catch-22, which is why you'll never see a film like this produced in the United States. So it is basically something that is really it puts a lot of light on what was developing. I mean, long-term capital management collapse, how Putin became the head of Russia, was all, you know, basically because people were trying to take over the country. And they were actually blackmailing Yeltsin. And, I mean, it's just the whole thing is just unbelievable. But this is the true story. It's really what happened. You know, they were trying to get me to join in with them. And I said, Russia's going to collapse. And they paid bribes to the IMF. They thought they had everything nailed down. And you can't do it that way. You just can't. So the film has been the highest rated documentary / movie, I guess, in Europe. It's all, you know, they don't want to show it in the United States. The other country which is interesting, which they're battling over, is Switzerland. A company bought the distribution rights to distribute it in Switzerland, and then they refused to show it. Paid for it, they don't want to show it. Because why? Because it affects all the banks. So in London, it had a debut in London. The very night of the debut, they took someone else who was a headhunter, and his name was Martin Armstrong. They put out a big article in the London Evening Standard over there saying Martin Armstrong says that bankers are worth every penny. And I'm getting calls and emails, oh, you should see what they're doing to you in the press over here. When I went online to look at it, it's got the other guy's picture. I said, no, no, no. I said, it's not me. It's this other guy. It just has the same name. they sent me a photograph of the print edition. It had my photograph. So the print edition has got my photograph. The online edition had somebody else's. You don't make mistakes like that. And it was the night of the debut.
So you think the elite are, they don't want this message to get too widespread?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, it's, you know, they don't want to expose what has really been going on. I mean, there's been a lot of people talking about it, but, I mean, I actually had all the proof. When it's talk, it's, you know, that's kind of cheap. But everybody knows, you know, the banks have been, you know, finagling markets. They don't get prosecuted for stuff. I mean, we had, and I published on our web, we had absolutely documentation of every manipulation going back into the 1980s. All right, phone conversations, tapes, etc. Because I would say they're back. They're going to take this market to here. They're going to do this one to there. I never said who, but I made sure I had everything documented in case somebody wanted to sue me. Somehow, some way, they found out about all that stuff. And the receiver, his name was Alan Cohen, threatened to throw all my lawyers in prison unless they turned over all those tapes. They turned them over. Alan Cohen then gets appointed magically as board member of Goldman Sachs, doesn't resign from the court, continues to work for the court and Goldman Sachs simultaneously. And then all this evidence that we had that would expose all the banks was magically destroyed in the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And I have a letter from the SEC. Oh, very sorry. All your files are gone. I published a letter on our web. So, I mean, I have things that are documented. So it's not just, you know, a bunch of hot air.
Well, you know, we appreciate your comments today, Martin Armstrong. You know, we're all a bunch of tall poppies. Would you like to provide any contact information for Princeton Economics?
Well, I think the easiest thing is basically just to go to our main retail site, which is armstrongeconomics.com. From there, you can get to the Princeton sites. You can get to our artificial intelligence system we call Socrates, where it basically forecasts every market in the world, every stock, things of this nature. It's a fully functioning AI system, which actually the computer writes it. It's been quite interesting on that as well. So
you say you have an artificial intelligence program which actually augments its own code to probably keep up with the shifting tides within the markets?
Yes, it's actually, we have one model in there which is very fascinating. It's called the Global Market Watch, which proves that everything that you may have been taught in school or they are still teaching in school is just outright wrong. Goes through all the markets historically and records patterns. And if it sees the same pattern in any market, it says, hey, this is going to take off, this is going to crash, this is going to... And it shows that it's the patterns that are uniform, not the fundamentals of a particular market.
Exactly. You know, trying to outsmart the markets typically backfires. It only makes sense because, you know, you have millions of people placing wagers. So,
well, I think our problem is we try to reduce it down to one thing. The market went up today because, all right, there's never a because, all right? Everybody acts out of their own self-interest. There are Europeans that are buying the market over here, not because of what we see domestically. It's because Europe is so bad, let me just get out of here. So everybody acts for different reasons. And this is why the computer is able to beat it, everybody, because it's looking for patterns. It, you know, everybody's going to respond according to their own self-interest. So it's the pattern of everybody, the movement. It's not what the fundamental is.
You're right. And I think it's that the human mind was originally hardwired over many thousands of years and probably much longer to look for cyclical patterns. I mean, look, we see the sunrise in the morning. It sets every night. This has happened for eternity, and it's going to continue to happen for another 5 billion years or so.
That's how we learn. I mean, you know, Every parent tells a child, don't stick your finger in the flame of a candle. It's going to hurt. Every child looks at the parent and says, really? And sticks his finger in, right?
Exactly. And you've got the seasons, okay? Right? We have the four seasons in most parts of in the Northern Hemisphere. And so these are the patterns that we've been hardwired. But the problem is, when you look at the markets, okay, it's a complex system. It's not a regular cyclical system. And that's where, you know, genetic algorithms and expert systems can take that quantum leap to the next level, that the everyday human is just not wired properly. Princeton Economics, Martin Armstrong. We want to wish you a really fantastic 2016. We've got another year headed here. Let's hope it's a better one. I want everyone to see the Forecaster movie.
Have a good holiday.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Bob Hoy. He's advised institutional clients for three decades, editor-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. That's all one word. Happy New Year, Bob Hoy.
Well, the best to you. We will be enjoying it this evening. I guess you will be, too.
It's been really a momentous year. I mean, we have seen just so much volatility. What do you see for 2016?
Well, more of the same, continuing. We're in extraordinary times. You know, every throughout all of history, the end of a great boom has always been exciting. It's always been volatile and choppy as the transition comes in. But you've never had one before where the authorities, central bankers and treasury departments, have been so trying so hard to keep a violent financial bubble going. And it's amazing that they even try. They live in a strange world, these central bankers. And one of the ironies is that I think that the Federal Reserve cannot raise the short rate because there's so much money sloshing around out there and there is so much risk out there that a lot of people, the safe money always parks in the most liquid items, like return doesn't matter. So a liquid item, perhaps one of the most, is the short-dated instruments in the U.S., treasury bills, and gold. So, but you've got here, so I don't think the market's allowing them to raise rates, but this doesn't mean that other interest rates will not go up. So, and we look back on the end of the great boom bubbles in 1873 and in 1929 and 2007, the senior central bank, the record there has been on the major changes in interest rates, the market rates, like T-bill rates or longer out, 1 year, maybe out to notes, changed, and then the central bank followed. So let's just take a look at this year. Long-dated treasuries set their lowest yield at the end of January, and they've gone up in yield since. And now, in the last 3 months, the debate about the Fed raising the rate was intense and absolutely absurd, because
whatever they did would be after market rates of interest increased. So some people will say that, oh, the market rates increased recently because the Fed was talking about raising rates. But you look at it, long-dated treasuries have been increasing in yield since January, February. And you have the case of, let's take junk bonds, triple C junk bonds. They set their low yield in June of 2014, and that was around 8%, and now they're around 18%. So what's the Fed got to do with that? Absolutely nothing. It was a change in the perception of risk, so the market forces have adjusted. But one of the things that's coming out at this year end is that many of the hedge funds did not have a good year. There were some market changes they didn't expect, a number of analysts, but we want to look at what we had going into last January. We were looking for what we called the rotation, where some of the depressed commodity sectors would rally, and they might rally out till around April or May, and they did. And in the case of gold, we've advised to accumulate a bit, not much, because it is all very precarious out there. Then the other one was the base metal prices. That was part of the rotation, and when they reached their peak in the spring, and then also to get out of the base metal mining stocks. On the credit market side, we had the credit spreads narrowing into around June, and they did. And then once that seasonal turn had started, the trend in the chart of credit spreads, and this was using the triple B or the triple C relative to treasuries, when that widening, if it had it broke out at certain levels in July, it would trigger off further breaks in commodities and in the stock market. And what it did do was trigger off the crash in the Shanghai market. There was no policy change there. It was just excessive speculation. And then the credit spreads turning. And it's always, I think, a little limiting with equity guys to sort of look at management or look at the general equity market and look at what the Fed's doing and try and figure out where stocks are going to go based on that. When underneath it all, it's the credit spreads that drive it. So that happened. And then we want to also mention on crude oil. This one goes back to the spring of 2014 when crude, we expected again its seasonal rally up until around May or June, and that's when it rallied up to 107. And I had an interview with one of the big two weekly magazines in Canada, and the writer there, Jason Kirby, was pretty bold because he put it out that we were looking for the rally to go up to around June. And then when it turned down because of the potential change in credit spreads, it could be a severe bear market for crude oil. And we had used it compared to in gold prices because it was the best way to look at it in the 1930s depression. So our view was that relative to gold, crude oil could fall to one-third of the high or to one-quarter. And then in translating that to actually dollar prices, yeah, we had 37 and 27. So the initial target was 37, which we've met. It got into the low end of the 35. But we still have the other target out there at 27. And it may not, well, it may not reach it in the next 3 or 4 months, but it could reach it later on the next year or so. And this will be when crude first started to go down, the conventional view was that, oh, great, this will bring gasoline prices down, and that'll put more money in the hands of the consumer. And, yeah, it's a theory, but the problem is that when crude oil goes down, as with other commodities going down, it signals a weaker economy. So then you have a weaker economy, you got poor employment and stuff like that. So it's not really a blessing. And then especially when you've got all those sovereign wealth funds who are, you know, lapping up all of the money coming in from high-priced crude and investing in everything else. So it's all in a contraction. So there's an old saying on long post-bubble depressions that with weaker grain prices, then the farmers are forced to plant from fence post to fence post because poor prices means they got to have more of the stuff to try and eke out a living. And we've quipped that this is the same thing in crude oil, that the oil people are, well, drilling from fence post to fence post. And the weaker the prices are, those that can produce economically are going to keep ramping up production as best they can. So crude oil has taken on a decline to a new price regime. And as we say, then after perhaps a rally into the first quarter for crude, continues on down. The feature of every post-bubble contraction, and on this one, the blowout in 2007 was a classic bubble, like 1929 or like 1873 or even as far back as 1825, that these contractions have lasted 20 to 25 years, of course, interrupted by the usual business cycle, and in this case, the first business expansion out of a classic crash, which ended in 2009, and the bull market that went with it, they're both now very mature. And we saw the Chicago PMI yesterday, and it's looking very weak. But at any rate, I think that the next leg down could be visible, say, after March or April, and it's going to be severe. So then with it is likely to be another phase of strengthening in the U.S. dollar, because years ago when I did the research, the obvious thing was that in a post-bubble contraction, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most other currencies. And I think the mechanism behind it is that in the financial bubble, everybody was reaching for yield, and of course, a whole lot of countries and corporations end up getting money if you have most of the debt that was expanded, written, and due and payable in U.S. dollars in New York. There you go. And once the compulsion becomes servicing the debt into the financial center, which is New York. So all of that debt written in New York, due and payable in U.S. dollars, you can call it a short position. And if you call it a short position, it must be the biggest one in history. So this then is a puzzle. It's a puzzle for the central banker who really believes that depreciating the U.S. dollar is a wonderful benefit. And when they can't do it, they just get, I guess it must be very frustrating to be a central banker these days.
Very true. But on the other hand, we have to keep in mind that it tends to be the herd that wakes up to all of these things that you're seeing 6 to 12 months in advance. It can take them a really long time. It can take the herd much longer to recognize the fact bull market is coming to a close. And after speaking with Martin Armstrong this week, the forecaster, he's forecasting as much as another 100% climb on the Dow that leads to a year 2000-like blow-off, which then culminates with the scenario you've just laid out. He thinks that the presidential year is going to be much stronger than people think, and then 2017 to 2020 leads to a grand down cycle unlike anything we've seen since 1929.
Oh, yeah. We will eventually have another severe bear market, as even the establishment said in 2008, 2009, that it was the greatest collapse since the 1930s, step one. Step two is that we've been on the first business cycle out of that, so it's sort of like 1937 or 38, which was a very dynamic stock market bounce out of that. So what I like to look at is, yes, there will be. As a matter of fact, I think the next phase of the contraction has already started, particularly in the credit markets. Like, you've got the yield for CCC junk bonds which in June of around 8%. Now it's around 18%, trading there for the last week or so. And the high in 2009 was 45%. So once you get a trend going on widening credit spreads, or in this case what I was talking about is an increasing yield for lower grade stuff, that trend goes for a long ways. And so that's what will guide us as to the bubble feature. In the 70s, the big speculation was in commodities, real estate, wages, consumer prices. The CPI went up to, 14%? And, of course, against that was the speculation in rising interest rates, where the long bond went up to 15%. Now, this is what the gold bugs have been hanging their hats on, was this relation to and silver and other commodities going up. The trick in that one was, that was 1980. 81 was high for the yield. And then commodities started to come down, and that's when I first started presenting to financial institutions. And they were all geared for it. They had finally figured out that it was the Fed that was causing inflation, and they were geared for that. But the point of view we took is what happened after the huge commodity inflation in 1920 crashed, and that crash then set up the bubble in financial assets. So the view in 1981 and 82 was, the quip was that I used was that no matter how much the Fed prints financial assets, stocks will outperform commodities. Well, that was impossible to accept at that time, and that indeed did happen. You've been in financial asset inflation then, with some couple of severe bear markets, 2000 and after 2007, but we are still in an era of financial asset inflation, and that's chosen by the public. And it's not chosen by gold bugs or silver bugs. It's the public. The public decides. So the point, and it's a subtle one, Chris, is that the Federal Reserve, in order to be reckless, has to have a bid out there for something, and it has to be a speculative bid that is highly leveraged. And you've seen that in the low-grade bond markets. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's just been a bloodbath there. There's no question.
Well, the crash has been, but the speculation, and also the speculation in euro yield with the German 10-year note getting down to 0.006 or something like that percent, that is like the equivalent of gold going to 10,000. So what's happening is you're going to get a crash in these financial assets, the equivalent of when gold crashed after 1980, a long, lengthy crash.
I think one of the aspects that is so appealing to these discussions, in general, people are specialists. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the mythical Sherlock Holmes was a specialist, and he was proud of that. I'm not going to fill my mind with worthless information. I'm going to fill it with the pertinent information that's going to help me solve these cases. Okay. I'd like to discuss something that I've noticed just looking over the past several years since the 2008 housing HGX index. And one can't help but notice a striking diamond pattern and reliable pattern, even more so than the head and shoulders. A novice would recognize it right away, regardless of the weekly, daily, or monthly periodicity. Over all of 2015, beginning around March, we can see another striking, albeit much smaller and tighter. We broke down 4 weeks ago, it started, and we've had a little bounce up to key what was support that now looks like resistance.
Yeah, but I think the big picture, Chris, is to where some people are looking for a huge bubble yet in stocks, is that the bubbles are elusive. We had a huge bubble in tangible things and commodities and wages in 1980. Then we've had a series of big financial bubbles, stocks, over the high techs in 2000. And what you have now is, and I want to really, I'm repeating it, Chris, is that we have had the same thing as the tech bubble in 2000, but in lower grade bonds. And as these go down, we're going to go into what I've been calling a bond revulsion. And it's not the revulsion that you had in the 1970s where yields went up because inflation was going up. It's going to be yields going up because of severe deflation, whereby most commodities are weak, and when they're weak, it indicates poor pricing power amongst most corporations. And if they haven't got pricing power, they're not making money, and they're having trouble servicing their debt. And then they may be investment grade, triple B, but the credit rating agencies, of course, are watching these like hawks, and they then will start marking down their agents. So it's a classic one, as old as the hills, that when you have a huge debt load, weakening commodities and weakening business is a disaster for servicing that debt. So I think that you've had the consumer price bubble and wages and commodities 1980. You've had a number of financial asset bubbles, equities, and now you have, in between 2008, you had a very vigorous commodity speculation, and crude got up to 147, and that's all changed now. So the last bubble has been in low-grade bonds, but it's also been in what could become low-grade bonds, and that's sovereign debt in Europe. It's been. I think that is going to be the dominant thing for next year. Will be a huge adjustment in credit spreads widening, and most bond prices falling in price and yields going up. It'll be a grinder, and that then will put a lid on the ability to speculate in stocks. We have been in a period of time, a horrendous experiment in authoritarian government. When were the periods of horrendous experiment in authoritarian government in the senior economy? The answer, 3rd century Rome, when it turned into a police state, and the 1600s, or the 1500s to the early 1600s, when the Catholic Church was turned into a police state, and in the 20th century, when you've seen the corruption in the United States now, which is the leading economy. 3rd century, 16th century, and 20th century. When was the period of chronic price inflation? The next question is, when was the chronic price inflation in the senior economy? I'm not talking about banana republics or Weimar republics. I'm talking about the senior economy. And the history shows the 3rd century with Rome, the 1500s, rampant price inflation, and then 20th century and still running. Okay, so then you go back to the two previous examples and you ask the question, how long did each one run? About 100 years. In the 3rd century, and then in about 310 or something, Constantine said, we're going to start doing the gold solidus, and then the inflation was over, and everything got quiet. So each one, it takes the bureaucracy about 100 years to spend all of the wealth that's accumulated and to go through, not only to spend that wealth, spend future wealth with debt, and then the public starts to wake up, and it says, what are these guys doing? Going back to the 3rd century, the state, the bureaucracy was running things, and it was, the head of it was called the genius of the emperor. Like, he could do no wrong. So then you get into the 1500s and early 1600s, it was the infallibility of the church. It could do no wrong. And what you have now, of course, is the infallibility of central bankers. It's the same thing as the genius of the emperor. So in each of the previous ones, the bureaucrats had screwed up so badly that the public took a look. It could happen on the election next year in the U.S. because it's the senior economy, but they've also been pushing that they can manage the climate. They can manage the temperature of the world. In the late 1700s, early 1800s, was spectacular, but it was not the concluding action that you saw at the end of the 1500s or the end of the 3rd century.
So you're talking about a sea change event that just topples whole continents.
Yeah.
So many of my top guests, reluctant but adamant to point out that they just see the worst ahead.
Well, I think we could call this ending action, and who knows how many years it'll take, but we are at the ending action, and as I said, that this time the promoters in government have been pushing two fraudulent stories, two superstitions. One, that they can manage the economy. Two, that they can manage the temperature of the earth. An old saying from the old and dreadful Vancouver Stock Exchange, and it'll put the perspective of government ambition in, it'll put government ambition in perspective, and that is the definition of a promotion. And it starts as, in the beginning, the promoter has the vision and the public has the money. And at the end of the promotion, the promoter has the money and the public has the vision. And at the moment, the public has the vision, and many economists do, that the economy can be managed. They also believe, many of them, too many do, that the temperature of the planet can be managed as well. So the public has the vision, and the governments have the money, and the promotion is now run its course.
Here, why don't you tell people more about the services you provide, please?
Yeah, we can be got, find out about us at institutionaladvisors.com, or as I was surprised to discover a number of years ago, that when you just put in my name, Bob Hoye, H-O-Y-E, bang, it all comes up on Google. So, we welcome your interest, and we provide a trial basis, a free one, the same stuff that we send to institutions and mining companies and analysts and everything else, portfolio managers. And it's all the same research goes out, and you can try it for a while, maybe 5 weeks.
I want you to have a fantastic new year.
All the best to you, Chris, and to our listeners.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. You might call your favorite beverage a soda or a pop. If it's an adult beverage and it comes from a brewery, you might call it a beer or an ale. When you pour your beverage quickly into a glass or mug, foam or a head can often form on top of your actual beverage. That foamy head can create the impression that you have a lot more beverage to enjoy than you really do. In fact, when the foam settles down, there is often a lot less liquid than you were led to believe. And no doubt, you need to top off your glass or mug to get the full benefit of what you expected. The takeaway from this little word picture is that the foam doesn't hold any significant substance. Yes, it fills your glass or mug, it tickles your nose, but it also quickly disappears, leaving a lot less substance in your glass, so that you're either going to have to accept the loss, find some way to top off or refill, or diminish your expectations altogether, and get a smaller glass that you pour this remaining amount into, so you can fool yourself into thinking you now have a new full glass. With the new year upon us, much commentary has ensued looking back and looking forward into the new year. A common theme is that much of what has been reported and focused on economically in the mainstream media has, in essence, been the frothy economic foam, which has tickled everyone's nose and caused some level of intoxication. But now that foam, it is predicted, will start to subside in 2016, leaving a baseline reality that has not improved since the financial collapse of 2008, but has in fact worsened. In a Greg Hunter interview, former Assistant Treasury Secretary Dr. Paul Craig Roberts said, "There has been no recovery whatsoever." He said, "When you consider the full measure of unemployment, we still have an unemployment rate of 23%, and that's after 7 years of an alleged recovery." He said, "How do you have 5% unemployment when half of all 25-year-olds have to live at home with their parents? What kind of recovery is that?" David Stockman, who headed up Ronald Reagan's Office of Management and Budget, reflected on 2008 by saying, "The market plunged and the C-suite panicked. 6 million jobs, most of which would never have been created in the first place, absent the Greenspan housing credit bubble, were deep-sixed within less than a year." Fast forward to today, Stockman says, the fast money has already realized that the jig is up, that the Fed is out of options, and recession is coming to these shores in a gale force from a faltering global economy, and that financial risk is rapidly coming out of hiding. He says, whatever savings and investments the middle class baby boomers have left is about to get monkey hammered good and hard. And John Williams from Shadow Stats has indicated that the Federal Reserve and other central banks have no way out as dangers from the panic of 2008 persist, and that a formal new recession recognition is likely early in the new year. Economic reality can only be outrun for so long. I am not sure of the timing when the financial tremors will turn into visible mainstream cracks, and then into full-fledged, off-the-Richter-scale financial earthquakes. But it is coming, and it won't take another 7 years to get there. Quantitative easing will have 9 lives. It will go on steroids. A New Year's Market Watch article discussed why first-time home buyers are sitting and staying on the sidelines. According to the National Association of Realtors, first-time home buyers long represented 40% of all buyers, but that share has shrunk substantially since 2008. In 2015, first-time home buyers made up less than 30% of all buyers. A young lady, 30 years old, commented in the article. She said, "I think it used to be a symbol of something a long time ago." She said, "I think that there's still a romantic notion of buying your own house and calling it your own and saying you own property. I think that's almost antiquated at this point." She said elsewhere in the article that a new job or graduate school might pull her away. In other words, she understands at an intuitive level that being a geographical prisoner to a mortgage in an unpredictable, rapidly changing, and uncertain set of economic circumstances is unwise. Welcome to the future. Chris, David Morgan has invited me to speak at his Las Vegas Solutions Conference on February 22nd, along with Chris Martinson, Greg Mannarino, and a team of experts. Details are at conquerchange.com, and until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.